It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thank you for being part of our Body Week. We take up the musculoskeletal system today. Issues related to bones, cartilage, ligaments, tendons, and connective tissues. Join in along the way on things like stiffness, inflammation, arthritis, call with questions, or your own health advice, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Dan Malone is a rheumatologist at Prairie Ridge Clinic of the Columbus Community Hospital. He is president of the Wisconsin Rheumatology Association. Dr. Malone, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, can you first give us a tour, if you will, a working knowledge of what the musculoskeletal system includes?
I think you outlined it pretty well. It is the system by which we can create movement. It also involves, not indirectly, much more directly, involves our immune system. So we as rheumatologists deal with conditions where our immune system is misbehaving, if I can just use a common term, and there are clinical consequences of that misbehavior that actually can be damaging to the various musculoskeletal tissues that you named, that is muscles, tendons, joints, ligaments. You have to include nerves in that equation as well, because everything in our body is connected, and this is especially connected by the vascular and the neurological systems, so that when you talk about the musculoskeletal system, you must also include the wiring, which is the nervous system, and the food supply, which is the blood vessels, the vascular system. So everything works in tandem, and as rheumatologists, we deal with disruptions of what we call homeostasis, which means normality, basically. And nature has built into us a whole bunch of checks and balances to keep things in tune, so to speak. So I think this can be said for virtually every system in the body of so-called higher beings, if you want to consider humans higher beings. Sometimes I wonder the way we behave. But in any case, even the more complex organisms, such as humans and larger, so to speak, animals, Mother Nature builds in counterbalancing systems. So, for example, if you think about the way our blood clots, there are chemical pathways that promote clotting, but then Mother Nature put in an equally powerful system of anticoagulant or anti-clotting proteins and chemical systems, so that the concept of yin and yang, which the Chinese have known about for 5,000 years, actually is quite apropos to human biology and biology in general. There's always a check and a balance on every system we have. And when we treat autoimmune disorders, we've sort of changed our approach to this. In the past 20 years or so, we are starting to figure out how to take advantage of and stimulate those systems that control the yin and the yang is what we're learning to treat. We were pretty much concentrated on suppressing the pro-inflammatory part of our immune systems in the past, and we're now figuring out how to stimulate the turnoff mechanisms, which actually works pretty darn well, since Mother Nature is the greatest engineer in the universe and has given us these methods by which our bodies can control anything that happens to us that is out of homeostasis, as I, you know, described previously.
So, you know, as you put these complex systems together, Dr. Malone, when would it be appropriate, or when would it be time to see a rheumatologist?
Well, Mother Nature built that into us too. When you have pain, when you have loss of function, your body will tell you when something is wrong. And it's up to the rheumatologist to interpret what you're telling that rheumatologist and figure out what is awry.
We're talking about the musculoskeletal system with Dr. Dan Malone here, rheumatologist at Prairie Ridge Clinic of the Columbus Community Hospital. You can join in with your questions along the way, 800-642-1234. Dr. Malone, let's turn to carpal tunnel syndrome, one of the most common nerve syndromes in the world. What causes carpal tunnel syndrome?
Well, any nerve in the body, when compressed, or even just touched with or subjected to any sort of malfeasance, will signal you in no uncertain terms. So a good example of that is when you hit your so-called funny bone on the inside of your elbow. We've all done that, and it is not a pleasant sensation, as you know. So when, if you can imagine a nerve being compressed as opposed to hit, the symptoms are also quite unpleasant. And so there is a nerve that if you look at the, we call the volar, or the front of your forearm, it's the palm surface of your arm, if you will. There is a nerve that runs right down the center of your forearm and into the wrist and into the hand, where it splits to feed the thumb, the index finger, the middle finger, and half of the ring finger. So that nerve is called the median nerve because of its position in the middle, median means middle, of the arm. Now, as it crosses the wrist, there is a ligament that goes across that nerve from the thumb side to the little finger side. That ligament is called the transverse carpal ligament, or the TCL. And what is very common, especially in people who do repetitive motions, work with their hands a lot. There are other disorders that predispose to this, like diabetes, low thyroid, and even pregnancy. It's not a disease, obviously, but it's a condition that can promote pressure of the ligament on the nerve. And when you start to put pressure on the nerve, you start to get numbness and tingling, which is usually the first symptom, in the distribution of that nerve, which, as I just said, is the thumb, the index, the middle, and half of the fourth digit, the finger. And if that is not relieved, this numbness and tingling can become pain. It tends to be worse at night. People find themselves shaking their wrist and putting their wrist in all kind of different positions to try and get relief from the symptoms. It is probably the single most common nerve compression syndrome on the planet in humans. And thousands and thousands of these operations to relieve that and are done every day. And the way it is cured is to simply go in there and cut the ligament, that piece of gristle, so to speak, that goes between the thumb and the little finger crossing over the nerve and compressing it. And the surgical approach is to make an incision in the wrist, at the kind of the heel of the hand, the base of the wrist, on the palmar side, and you dissect down to the ligament, and you snip it with the scissors and close. That's the surgical approach. This can also be treated with less invasive, using what's called an endoscope, which is basically a fiber optic camera that is inserted into the wrist. And so the surgeon can see on a video screen where the blade is going and can relieve and can cut the ligament that way. A more novel technique is the one I do. It's called a thread carpal tunnel release. And the way that works is, instead of using a knife or a blade or a scissors to cut the ligament, instead, under ultrasound, I can loop a cutting thread around the ligament with both ends of that thread protruding through a small needle stick in the palm of the hand. And by just pulling alternatively on each of the protruding threads back and forth, this essentially runs the cutting thread right through the ligament and cuts the the ligament without any incision and without any stitches.
Can I ask just to pause here? Are there any wrist bending exercises that would be good for prevention? You know, some people do yoga where you're on all fours and you flip your palms around to face you. Is there anything you can do in terms of exercises to get ahead of it?
Well, there are methods like that. Wrist splints is a very common one. Yoga, there are other positional or physical therapy interventions to ameliorate symptoms. But the bottom line is that in most people, pregnancy is an exception because that's a temporary condition. But in most people, at some point, the symptoms become annoying enough and interfere with sleep enough, which is a huge problem. Poor sleep is responsible for a lot of medical conditions, and enough is known about that, I might add. But in any case, at some point, the patient gets just sick and tired of getting woken up at night and shaking their wrists all the time, and they will seek surgical correction.
Rheumatologist Dan Malone fielding questions about the musculoskeletal system, the wide range of conditions that can lead to problems related to sitting and walking and moving. Call in about your experiences. Share what you're wondering. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our musculoskeletal system is essential for staying on the move, and we discuss the framework supporting and shaping our body, also protecting those delicate internal organs like the brain and the heart and the lungs, which we've talked about this week. Call in with your questions, your advice related to bones, muscles, and joints, 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Dan Malone, president of the Wisconsin Rheumatology Association. Let's take a call now. Mary in Bayfield. Mary, hi. Go ahead.
Hi there. I have a question about eczema. I don't know if this falls under the category of what we're talking about, but whether or not it is truly an autoimmune disorder, and whether diet, in particular sugar, impacts it, also stress, and how the doctor feels about cortisone cream as a treatment. It seems like mine has gotten worse with age. And dermatologists, when I've seen them, I haven't really been given any, solutions that have been helpful. So I'm just wondering if there's anything else I can do or if there's any new treatments for it.
Mary, thank you. Dr. Malone.
Yes, eczema is now considered, an autoimmune disorder. And traditionally, when I was talking about treating autoimmune disorders in the past, we have used the method of suppressing the pro-inflammatory parts of our immune system. So in this case, the target organ is the skin. So the immune system, we ordinarily don't know the cause of why the immune system decides to behave this way. But in any case, in the case of eczema, the target organ is the skin, and there is this flaky inflammatory condition. And in the past, we have used what are called corticosteroids. So you probably heard of prednisone. There are different types of steroids, but the corticosteroids are those steroids that are the most potent immunosuppressant drugs, or among the most potent that we know. And so we use them topically, we use them intravenously, we use pills, we use all sorts of various ways of applying the steroid to the target organ. Now with the skin, it's easy because it's on the outside, we can put a cream on it. However, if that fails, over the last 15 years, the world of the so-called biologic drugs has exploded. And these new medications have absolutely revolutionized the world of treating autoimmune disorders. And we have been using biologic agents to treat virtually every rheumatic disease, including the common ones like rheumatoid arthritis, We use it to treat lupus. We use them to treat myositis, which is muscle inflammation caused by immune dysfunction. There are a wide variety of these biologic agents in all branches of medicine, not just musculoskeletal. And this came out of Nobel Prize winning technology that is called monoclonal antibodies. You've probably heard of monoclonal antibodies. They are widely used in the laboratory for detecting things, but they are also used to go after a very specific, say, a chemical messenger in the immune system. So the monoclonal antibody will grab a hold of one thing and one thing only. It's very, very specific. These biologic agents have now been used in, as I say, all branches of medicine, cardiology, lipid disorders, and there are now some of these biologics that are being used for people who have recalcitrant eczema. And it sounds like your case has been a pretty tough one to treat. Now, I'm assuming that you have seen competent dermatologists and that the diagnosis is correct. We can never design the proper treatment for a condition unless we have the proper and the correct diagnosis. So when you go to the doctor, you're really going to get a diagnosis. And assuming that the diagnosis is correct, I have no reason to doubt it, but you have a recalcitrant case of eczema, and there are more advanced biologic treatments for that. And I would recommend that you would just inquire with your dermatologist if one of those might be appropriate for your case.
Mary, thank you for the call. As we talk with a Wisconsin rheumatologist, Dr. Dan Malone, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Jim in Wisconsin Rapids with a question. Hi, Jim, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question regarding sciatic. I had a pinched nerve in my L4, L5 area due to a herniated disc or bulging disc back June through the end of December. Now the pain is gone, but what I've been left with is a pretty numb, a lot of numbness in my right foot. My question is there something I can do to help expedite the return of feeling in that foot, or will it come back naturally, or is this something that's going to be there for a while?
Well, in the first place, Jim, let me just say that God did us no favors by making us upright creatures. That's number one. And we have, I think the second most common complaint when people go to the doctor is low back pain. And your condition is extremely common, where these discs kind of squish out as we age. They become less and less resilient, and they start to squish out like squeezing a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Well, the contents of the sandwich squeeze out between the bread. And in the body, that's the disc. And the disc can squeeze out enough that it begins to impinge upon the nerve. So this is essentially another nerve compression syndrome, this one in the low back, and it affects the sensory nerves. That is, the nerves that carry information about sensation, as opposed to the motor nerves, which move muscles. There are two different kinds. Well, in this case, your disc was pushing on the sensory nerve that feeds the back part of your leg on the right side. And that goes all the way down. That nerve starts at the spine, goes all the way down to the sole of the foot. Now, I presume that they either did injections, or they took part of that disc out, or they did something to relieve the compression on that nerve. The other thing you need to know about nerves is they heal very slowly. They are probably one of the slowest healing tissues in the body. And it's not possible for me to predict when or to what degree this numbness will recede in your leg. Some numbness may be there for a long time. What I would recommend is that you consult the surgeon or the pain management docs who did the procedure that gave you partial relief. They will tell you whether this is due to continuing compression or if this is just an unavoidable complication of your illness, or if something can be done about it.
Jim, thank you for the call. We have Wisconsin Rheumatology Association President Dr. Dan Malone fielding questions about inflammation and stiffness, joint pain, associated with aging, how to build a strong musculoskeletal system. We'll talk more. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's Body Week here, and we focus on musculoskeletal conditions that cause pain, as well as decreased mobility and agility, impairing our ability to function. Call in with your questions for rheumatologist Dan Malone, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Malone, let's turn to arthritis, which affects tens of millions of people. How do you advise patients who are experiencing pain in their joints for the first time?
Arthritis is a broad term, and it actually, the strict definition of it means inflammation in a joint. This is commonly signaled to the patient by pain, stiffness, and loss of range of motion. Now, there are 100 different causes of this. The most common kind of arthritis in the world is called osteoarthritis, also called degenerative arthritis, or more commonly wear and tear arthritis. And essentially what happens in this condition is, as you're probably aware, human beings didn't live much past the age of 40 up until about 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago. So we evolved to live 40 years, 30 or 40 years. We didn't have time to develop osteoarthritis. Now that people are living into their much later years, cartilages wear out. Mm. And cartilage is the main constituent, the main ingredient in the various coverings of the bone in our joints. So cartilage is very important. It shields the bones from rubbing on each other, basically. And as we age, the cartilage gets thinner and thinner and thinner just naturally. It can be accelerated by injuries. This is why people who play American football and other contact sports or sports that will injure knees end up with knee replacements when they're in their 40s and 50s. It's because the typical response to a severe injury is the development of osteoarthritis. So that is, and that can occur in any joint, the hips, the knees, the fingers, the elbow, anywhere. It's most common in the fingers, the knees, and the hips. And that's why those are the joints, the hips and the knees anyway, are the most commonly replaced joints, because they are both weight-bearing joints and therefore are subjected to forces of bearing the body weight. And so the cartilage wears out quicker. Mm.
Donna in Madison called in to ask you if there is a link between rheumatoid arthritis and cardiovascular disease.
There definitely is. We have known for decades that people who have rheumatoid arthritis, which is an inflammatory autoimmune rheumatologic condition, are at higher risk for cardiovascular disease. That means heart attacks and strokes, basically. And we've learned over the past 50 years that there is a huge inflammatory component to the blockage of arteries, which causes heart attacks and strokes. So the two are linked in that they are both inflammation-related conditions. And it turns out that the more active the inflammation is in rheumatoid arthritis, the higher is the risk for cardiovascular events. Now, this is completely independent of the treatment. Hmm. in the sense that it's not the medicines that cause the cardiovascular problems. It's the rheumatoid arthritis that causes the cardiovascular problems. And what we've also learned is now that we have these wonderful new medications that has reduced the severe outcomes of rheumatoid arthritis by dramatic proportions, the newer biologic agents, as we control the rheumatoid arthritis inflammation, we note that the risk of the cardiovascular events goes way down. So by decreasing the inflammation, the systemic inflammation associated with the autoimmune rheumatoid arthritis, we can lower the risk of the cardiovascular events. But yes, there's clearly an association.
Is there any knowledge about why women develop rheumatoid arthritis much more than men do?
No, there is. That's true of most autoimmune disorders. Not all, but most autoimmune disorders are more prevalent in one gender or the other. Lupus, for example, is 8 times more common in women than it is in men. That disproportionality is the reason for that is not entirely clear. We don't understand, first of all, where these diseases come from. We don't understand that very well. We're figuring it out, but we're not to that point yet. So we don't really understand this gender disparity issue. Some rheumatic disorders are more common in men. Most of them are more common in women.
Dr. Dan Malone is here, president of the Wisconsin Rheumatology Association Practices in Columbus. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jordan in Chicago with a question. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, how are you doing? Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question related to one of the callers. She asked about eczema. I have autoimmune disease that is, the name is vitiligo, which causes white spots on my skin. I have mainly this on my hands, my palms, and some portion of my face. So it's not that bad. But I was very curious when the Dr. Malone mentioned that there's new technology treating the cause, because this autoimmune disease, nobody in my family ever had anything like that. They said stress may be cause or something like that. As I was under great stress several years ago when it appeared. I'm not sure about that. But is there any treatment at all in the future?
I would say that, first of all, you bring up a good point. And there is a clear-cut, well-known and well-recognized association between stress, and that's stress of any kind, loss of a loved one, going to war, divorce, any sort of stress can result in flare-ups of virtually any autoimmune disorder or trigger the onset of any autoimmune disorder. When it comes to vitiligo, which is, I think, what you're talking about here, that is now considered an autoimmune disorder. It's a little bit out of my area of expertise. I am not a dermatologist, but nonetheless, this is another condition like eczema where advances have been made, and it's very possible. And I don't know that this is true, but I would check with your dermatologist to see if there are any newer treatments available. Some of the biologics may be effective in treating vitiligo. It's not a life-threatening disorder. It is a cosmetic and disfiguring disorder, but there well may be newer treatments available for this.
Jordan, thank you for the call. We heard from Mark in Green Bay. Dr. Malone called to ask you about testing patients for Lyme disease. And Mark noted, sufferers experience a great deal of pain. And what would you say about Lyme disease?
Lyme disease is a condition that is, as you know, very common in Wisconsin. And there's a ton of controversy about whether there's such a thing called chronic Lyme disease. What we know about this is that there clearly is a subgroup of people who get Lyme disease that suffer long-term symptoms that are almost indistinguishable from PTSD indistinguishable from fibromyalgia, which is a chronic pain syndrome. And we have to keep in mind that the Lyme disease organism, which is a funny looking bacterium, does have a tendency to go to the central nervous system. It can affect the brain. It can affect any part of the nervous system. So it's not at all too surprising that Lyme disease can result in long-term symptoms. It is not proven that this is caused by a persistence of the infectious agent. In other words, there's no proof that live Lyme bacteria are still swimming around in the patient. Could that be possible? Yes, but there's no good proof that that's the case. I personally think, this is my opinion, that changes in the central nervous system as a result of the primary infection result in biochemical imbalances in the brain, especially in the primitive parts of the brain, that cause these symptoms to go on and on and on. The most recent culprit that we have all heard about that's responsible for a similar sort of chronic, persistent set of symptoms is COVID. It too has a tendency to infect the central nervous system. And when you look at other infections of the central nervous system, that being the brain and the brain's coverings and the spinal cord, any virus or bacteria that can infect the central nervous system, some unfortunate patients, and we don't really know what the risk factors are for this, but some of these patients develop a chronic syndrome. They just can't get rid of these symptoms, and it's very difficult to treat.
We have Dr. Dan Malone with us, rheumatologist in Columbus and South Central Wisconsin. Still time to talk about musculoskeletal conditions, issues with aches and pains. Be part of the conversation, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about musculoskeletal conditions that significantly limit mobility and dexterity, especially as we age. We have rheumatologist Dan Malone with us. Let's take another call. Stan in New Prospect. Hi, Stan.
Hi, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. I'm 75 years old now, and I got a problem with my sciatic nerve, and it's not consistent. It's more during the winter months when if I do a little more driving. But anyway, what I was thinking is, you know, we're getting older. I'm probably about 2.5 inches shorter than what I used to be. So my body is compressing. Now, what I was thinking of doing is possibly to relieve the pressure on the sciatic nerve, maybe help straighten out my spinal column. Is I'm looking at a hay wagon right now. And what I was thinking, many, many years back, they used to advertise some type of exercising upside down. So if I would, I'm trying to devise a pulley system where I can pull my feet up in the air and hang from that there for a little while and maybe do a couple exercises for a few minutes. Would that make any sense? Because I'm reversing the pull, gravity pull on my body, and not only make me taller again. No, I'm just joking.
Stan, thank you.
Maybe take the pressure off the spinal column.
Dr. Malone.
Stan, whenever we have a brilliant idea like that, somebody's already thought of it. And in this case, you are absolutely correct. Hanging upside down is actually a well-known treatment, and you don't have to invent anything. In fact, I'd probably recommend that you don't risk breaking your neck if it doesn't work, but rather get what's called an inversion device. And you can probably find these at any of your local health clubs. And basically what it is, it's a board that you stand up and lean against, and that board tips. And what it can do, it can actually hang you upside down with obviously there's ankle braces that you use so that you don't fall off the thing, but it will invert you and hang you upside down for as many or as few seconds as you like. This is clearly beneficial. And you should probably do this under the guidance of either a physical therapist or somebody who knows what they're doing at your local health club, and just tell them you want to get on the inversion table, and they'll show you how to do that. But it will help you. I will pretty much guarantee you that it will help you. And you're correct in that the reason you've lost 2 inches in height is that the discs between your backbones, your vertebrae, so you can think about bricks and mortar. The bricks are your bones. The mortar can squish out because it gets a little bit less compressible as you age. And so when it squishes out like that, the bones get closer together. And you've got about, probably 25 or so of those discs. And if you lose a millimeter in each of those discs, that's 25 millimeters, that's an inch. So it doesn't take much for you in each vertebrae, for each disc, if it gets a little bit compressed, the overall total is that you lose an inch or two, and this is normal.
Hmm. Stan, thank you for that call. We also heard from Scott in Waukesha, called to share about their recurring issue with their IT band running along the outside of their thigh, and they say it only hurts while standing for a few minutes. And when they move around, it's okay. And do you have any suggestions on the IT band?
Yes. The IT band is a big band of fibrous tissue that runs along the outside of the leg. And it starts up at your near the hip joint on the outside of the leg. Hip joint is actually in the groin, but the bony protuberance on the outside of your upper thigh. It starts there and it runs all the way down to on the outside of the leg and attaches to a bone below the knee. That iliotibial band or IT band can rub against the bony protuberance, bony protuberances of the knee near the joint, and can cause a lot of discomfort. What I recommend is that you go to a practitioner. Now, this can be a rheumatologist, it can be a rehab doc, it could even be an orthopedic surgeon, but one who does ultrasound, musculoskeletal ultrasound. They can precisely localize where the rubbing is occurring and can probably give you a therapeutic injection or other orthobiologic treatment to relieve that discomfort. Along with some physical therapy, they might want to put wedges in your shoes in order to relieve some of the tension, but there are ways of dealing with that.
When should a patient consider steroids or injections for, say, strained tendons?
That's a real can of worms. In the past, we used corticosteroids injections quite a bit. And in many patients, a single injection is reasonable to try. And in some cases, that will take care of the problem for good. In other cases, you kick the can down the road, meaning few months later, the symptoms come back. Mm. So steroids are great, but they don't cure the problem in some cases. For recurrences of the same condition, that's where the world of the so-called orthobiologic treatments come in. And I think I'm a believer in orthobiologic treatments, not for every ache and pain, but for some conditions, the injection of, instead of steroids, we take the patient's own body fluids, such as platelet-rich plasma or other body fluids that come from the patient themselves. These can be very beneficial in causing the healing of tendons that won't heal. And that's usually the problem, is that the tendons are frayed and the structure is disrupted, and they just aren't healing. They're not proceeding to the repair phase of healing. And in some cases, I have seen very good outcomes using the orthobiologic treatments. Now, what's the downside? There are very few, actually. And that's what makes these desirable, is that the risk is virtually nil when you're using what are called autologous fluids. That means fluids that come from the body of the patient themselves, as opposed to somebody else. So the risk being low, the benefit to risk ratio is very high. So it's worth a try.
Worth a try. We're going to circle back to arthritis here for a moment with Barbara from Appleton, who called in to wonder, how do you go about diagnosing whether a person has arthritis? Is it through X-rays, Barbara asks.
The diagnosis of arthritis is made by the patient. Basically, they come in and tell me, hey, my joint hurts, or my joint won't move, or my range of motion in my shoulder or my knee is vastly decreased. My job is to figure out what type of arthritis that is. And I employ the history and the physical, which is the starting point, should be the starting point of any medical encounter. Is the doctor or the provider asks the patient a series of directed questions and then does a physical examination. The first step is not an MRI. The first step is a history and a physical examination. Based on that, I then will employ x-rays, blood tests, ultrasound, other modalities to try and get to the answer. So the patient is not, the burden of the diagnosis is not on the patient. The burden of the diagnosis is on the doctor. That's me. It's my job to figure out what type of arthritis it is. And only after I do that can I design a rational treatment.
We only have less than a minute left, but what is the most important thing that a person can do today to keep their musculoskeletal system healthy?
I think it's, in general, keep yourself at your ideal body weight or as close to it as you can. Keep moving. Do some form of exercise. That doesn't mean you have to go to the gym and lift 700-pound weights. Walking 3 miles is as good as running 3 miles. The only difference is the time it takes. You still expend calories, and keeping muscles and joints, by the way, muscles, joints, and bones all have sensors in them that sense mechanical stress, which is normal. And when they sense mechanical stress, they strengthen the bone and tissues. So I would say, keep moving, eat healthy, and try and maintain your ideal body weight.
Dr. Malone, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Dan Malone is a rheumatologist at Prairie Ridge Clinic of the Columbus Community Hospital in Columbus and president of the Wisconsin Rheumatology Association. If you missed any part of Body Week and the systems we covered with all the docs, go to WPR.org/mornings, scroll down to the Body Week series, and while you're there, tell us what we should talk about next. Fill out our two-question online form, and thank you so much for being part of the conversation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.